since I didn't have time to put the introduction on, I thought I would put a human element into it also. So I'd like to just, is there some chalk around? I'd like to just motivate before starting the talk. So isomonogamy deformations have an ancient history, and it really goes back to, inverse monogamy problems go back to Riemann and Hilbert. And in fact, the Fuchsian case, the inverse monodromy drama, formed the content of Hilbert's 21st problem. that's fine. Now, if you could dose the other one, that would be good. So that's just the inverse monogamy problem, how to reconstruct essentially a rational covariant derivative operator on the sphere with given monogamy data in the case of simple poles only. Or is it, the whole question is whether that is an invertible problem, which was pretty well settled almost positively some time ago with at least in suitable generic circumstances. But then the question is, what about deformations? Deformations that preserve the monodromy but change the operator. And that also goes back a long time. The Fuchsian case, which is essentially simple poles, was pretty well settled for continuous deformations, so differentiable deformations. More than 100 years ago, around 1905, through the combined work of, Schlesinger and previous work by Lazar Fuchs. And also, this related to work of, Panlevé and his student Garnier. So that all goes back about 100 years. Panlevé, of course, treated systems of deformations which were not necessarily Fuchsian. So there were results, some individual results for the non-Fuchsian case also, which go quite far back. And then the non-Fuchsian case in a systematic way, at least the inverse problem, was put on a precise footing by Birkhoff. But he had nothing to say about the uniqueness of the inverse problem or anything to do about deformations. It came back into fashion mainly through physics motivations around the 1970s. So let's say more recent interest in this question of isomonodromy deformations. This is for Birkhoff introduced the notion of generalized monodromy, which I'll explain in a moment with the transparencies. Monodromy data. He identified what the corresponding complete set of data should be for non-Fuchsian systems. And there was a revival of interest, dating from at least the 1970s, which came partly from, motivated partly by considerations in integrable systems. Such as the, so this is physics motivation. Integrable systems, such as those arising in fluid dynamics, for instance, the so-called KP hierarchy, which describes an infinite set of compatible differential equations which have applications to fluid dynamics and plasmas. And the main point is that one found that equations of the type studied by Panlevé introduced a set of transcendents, Panlevé 1 to 6, which were, I won't go into the details of the historics of that. Panlevé 6 is related to a Fuchsian isomonogramic deformation equation. The others are degenerate, these like hypergeometric coalescences. And the point was that in studying classical integrable systems like the KP hierarchy, it was found that scaling reductions or multi-scaling reductions gave rise to equations which were of the isomonogramic deformation type. So typically, you could get the panel of A equations out of the KP hierarchy by imposing invariance under scaling transformations. Also, in quantum field theory and other considerations, in fact, even in string theory, there were settings where equations of this type arose. So there was also in the study of the Ising model new applications of such equations. So this is the problem in statistical mechanics, lattices, and this was due to the work of Tracy McCoy Wu back around 1970, which led to renewed interest in the panel of A equations. Then it was found later on in connection with string theory and matrix models that these type of equations arise all over the place. So there were also matrix model motivations, which is partly connected with string theory. There's always some scaling invariance involved. Anyway, there were lots of reasons to look at this systematically, and the people who revived the work of, who took up where Schlesinger and Birkhoff left off, first of all, there was Hermann Flaschke. This is around 1980 or so. There was Hermann Flaschke and Newman, who studied a particularly interesting case generalizing the panel of A's, but that was only 2x2 systems. And then there was a systematic study which completed, in some sense, the classification, the way that Schlesinger did for the Fuchsian case, which was done by Miwa, Jimbo Miwa, and Ueno in 1981. And they gave pretty systematic account of what the most general non-Fuchsian isomonodromic deformation problem was in terms of the Birkhoff data for arbitrary rank operators and rational singularities on the Lingen sphere. And they introduced in the process, because this was very much related to work on integrable systems, both classical and quantum, and they introduced the notion, which was already existing in the context of integrable systems, of a tau function, isomonogramic tau function, which was a key ingredient in the whole theory. And I'll describe that to you a little bit later on. So that was a very important observation, that this was the object, this isomonodonic tau function that really controls the whole system. And I should say that right from the earliest work, going back to the work of Penlevet and Garnier, it was noted that the continuous deformations that preserve the monodromy or the generalized monodromy of the differential operator could be viewed as Hamiltonian systems. They were actually Hamiltonian deformations. And so the Hamiltonian structure has appeared and reappeared, but not in a very systematic way since the very earliest work, since the work of Garnier, etc. And this was also touched upon in special cases in the work of Jimbo and Miwa, the Hamiltonian structure, at least for the Fuchsian case, and the so-called Garnier systems. And, I made a contribution back in 1994, which showed that the Hamiltonian structure of such isomonodromic deformation equations could be traced back to something which is also very familiar in integrable systems, the so-called R matrix Poisson structure, so classical R matrix. Poisson structure, which is, in the simplest case, in the rational case, can be thought of as a Poisson structure on loop algebras. That provides a kind of general phase space setting in which you can embed everything. And I'll describe that later on also. And then the question was, how could one systematically put in or understand the deformations in Hamiltonian terms using the phase space setting provided by the R matrix Poisson structure? Several people, I'll describe that later on, participated in subsequent developments. In particular, the work that I'll describe is largely based on some collaboration with Marco Bertola. Jacques Urtubiz, and my former postdoc, Gábor Pusztai. The work was essentially completed already some time ago, 2004, but there are some loose ends that are still up in the air, which hopefully will be completed very soon, but you won't be seeing those because I'll carefully hide them when I give my description. Okay, so that's the background motivation, and now I'd like to turn to the details. So, that's an outline. Is there a pointer or something or other? Okay, well, I can't really point to this, and I can't point to that. So, and I didn't put in the selective pauses so that I could, you know, sort of creep up on it. So I'll just have to point from here. Okay, so that's the outline. There's basically four sections. The first will deal with the notion of generalized isomonodromy deformations. I have to describe what the monodromy data is, generalized monodromy data that is invariant under these deformations. I'll start with the Fuchsian case. Great. Let's see. It just pushes something. Okay, great. So I'll start with that. And then I'll discuss the implementation of the Hamiltonian structure using this R matrix, classical R matrix. Then there are a few theorems having to do with how to identify the relevant Hamiltonians. The thing about this R matrix structure is if it's used in the broader setting of isospectral rather than isomonodromic, so deformations that preserve the spectrum of a linear operator, then the R matrix theory essentially gives all possible such isospectral deformations in terms of the ring of some invariants associated with the operator. But not, and some of these, if the system is reinterpreted as a non-autonomous Hamiltonian system, provide for isomonodromic deformations. So the key is that the passage from isospectral to isomonodromic is the passage from an autonomous Hamiltonian system to a non-autonomous one. But not all of them do. So the question was exactly which of the spectral invariants or the, that generate isospectral flows in the autonomous setting also generate isomonodromic deformations of the associated operator or matrix when the system becomes non-autonomous. So one theorem is to identify exactly what those are, and that turns out to be very natural. It turns out one has an ambient Poisson structure in the space in the loop algebra, or the dual of the loop algebra, and it turns out that when you turn it into a non-autonomous system, you're trying, in a sense, to restrict its symplectic leaves, but the symplectic leaves are not preserved by the deformations. However, there are equivalence classes of isomorphic symplectic leaves, and so there's a sort of trivial part of the deformation which takes you from one symplectic leaf to another isomorphic one. And what turns out to be the driver for the non-autonomous system is exactly what appears in the original setting as a Casimir invariance. That sounds paradoxical because Casimirs are not supposed to generate flows, but I'll explain to you in what sense this happens when we switch to the non-autonomous setting. Basically, it's for those who are familiar, it's basically the usual game between contact or multi-contact structures and symplectic structures. Okay, so that'll be the third part. Then as an example of such isomonogramic system, which is very important, in fact, for matrix models, I'll give you one example where these equations and Hamiltonians can be identified in relation to the deformations of semi-classical orthogonal polynomials. Okay, so that's the outline. So here's the general setting. One has a rational covariant derivative operator. X is just a coordinate. Just think of it as a point in the complex plane, but this is really the Riemann sphere, so we're allowing compactification and poles at infinity. A of X is a rational m by n matrix valued function. Here I've taken it as traceless because the traces are can be factored out or can be subtracted. They're invariants. So it could be GL or SL. Each of the terms here, this is essentially a partial fraction decomposition of this matrix valued function, rational matrix valued function. Here are the various principal parts. Zero corresponds to infinity. That's the point at infinity. And so the number of finite poles is n. And the local principal part looks like this. We just sum over those, and that's your rational function in a partial fraction decomposition. And then you have the piece at infinity, which is a polynomial. So those are poles of arbitrary order at infinity. And one is interested in a fundamental system, meaning the kernel of this operator. So this will be an m by m invertible matrix that satisfies this differential equation. And one puts in one generic assumption, although it's possible to extend this, to remove this assumption. But going back to the work of Jimbo and Miwa, we kept this assumption. Namely, if you look at the highest order term in this principal part, the one of degree d nu plus 1, then that matrix should have a simple spectrum. And that's an assumption. Otherwise, you get into lower dimensional strata, which you have to take care of separately. But it can be handled. So that simplifying assumption is being added. Here, the lambdas are just the eigenvalues of the various matrices, or the spectrum in the general sense. OK, so that's what we're dealing with. And what we're going to look at is deformations. I mean, we want to look for families of such operators, such that their generalized monodromy is invariant. And I have to define what is meant by that. So first of all, to do that, one goes through a standard procedure. You look at local formal asymptotics at each pole. So this is well-known standard theory. The local asymptotics and the assumptions that I gave involve a term which, now this is formal. So the actual asymptotics may not coincide with this form, except in sectors, the so-called Stokes sectors, in which case you may have a genuine asymptotic expansion. But this, for the moment, is a formal expression in which y you should think of as the holomorphic part and exponential of t as the singular parts, so in a local asymptotic expansion. So the t, so y looks like some constant matrix times something which, as x approaches the pole, approaches the identity, k is invertible. And the exponential factor could have a logarithmic term, which means that you could have polynomial behavior, your exponentiating logarithm. And it could have essential singularities of arbitrary order. The order is determined by the integer d, which tells you the order of the pole of the covariant derivative operator. That's called the Poincaré index. So if d is 0, all the d's are 0, that's a Fuchsian system. That means that there are only first-order poles in A, and the only type of singularity you have, the only type of asymptotics, in that case, is not sectorial. In that case, you really do have local asymptotics about each pole. But if it's, as is well known, if the D of the Poincaré index is non-zero, then you have only sectorial asymptotics and Stokes phenomena. So that's the general form of the asymptotic. Also at infinity, it's at the same on the same footing. And now, the T, which is here, the formal solution, can always be diagonalized, but not by conjugation. It's by, so to speak, a gauge transformation. One can locally always diagonalize, so it's possible to choose the t's as diagonal, and the entries in this diagonal matrix are the deformation parameters. And this was already shown by Birkhoff and was taken up again by Jimbo Miwa-Ueno. So the only pertinent parameters in the asymptotic data which will allow to move are the locations of the poles, alpha, nu goes from zero, well, from one to infinity, we only look at the finite poles, and then about all of the poles, including the one at infinity, we have these factors which are diagonal, they're the entries in a diagonal matrix, EA is just the elementary matrix with a one in the AA diagonal position, zero square. So this is the most general expression for a diagonal matrix summed over the diagonal entries, A, there are M of those, these are M by M matrices, and then over the various degrees of the polar part, and over the various locations of the poles, plus this logarithmic term. So the T's are the deformation parameters together with the location of the poles, alpha. That's what will allow to change. If those don't change, then you're not going to get any deformations that preserve monogamy. So those are the independent variables. You could say it's, in a sense, part of the monogamy data, certainly the asymptotic data. those are what are allowed to change. Then the data which completes the monogamy, this is an overcomplete set of data. The main set of data is the Stokes matrices. So at each pole, you've got 2D plus 1, 2D nu plus 1 Stokes sectors, which overlap. They're like slices of a pie, which overlap. And the actual asymptotic solution that coincides with the formal one takes a different form in each sector. And so when you relate these solutions for the same formal asymptotics, they're related by right multiplication by a constant matrix, and that's the Stokes matrix. So relating a Stokes sector J to the J plus 1 Stokes sector. This is the standard Stokes phenomena. To complete that data, one really has to take one reference point, which could be the point at infinity, and add in the so-called connection matrices, which essentially tell you through parallel transport or holomorphically transport how you can relate the behavior, local behavior at each pole to one reference point, just to have a fixed basis to compare with. So those are also part of the generalized Birkhoff monodromy data. Now, the actual monodromy has to do with the representation of the monodromy group, which just means pi 1 on the punctured sphere with all the poles removed. But this is not independent. The monodromy, so if you take a little walk, stroll around any of the poles, you're going to pick up a mapping into SLM, because the solution will change at most by right multiplication by a constant. That's the monodromy matrix related to that particular element of the fundamental group. But that's not independent data, because if you go around the loop, you're going to be taking your Stokes matrices, and they're going to compose to give you monodromy. So the Stokes data is already sufficient to determine, together with the connection matrices, the monodromy. So I mention this because this is the traditional data, which is the only thing that's necessary for a Fuchsian system, whereas for a non-Fuchsian system, we have the Stokes data. So I'll be talking a lot about the monodromy representation, but in fact, that is secondary to the Stokes data and connection matrices in the non-Fuchsian case. But it's all the data you need in the usual Fuchsian problem. So the question is, if you allow these parameters, deformation parameters, to move, location of the poles, and the diagonal formal asymptotic exponential factors and logarithmic factors, actually, you don't move the logarithmic factors, because those are part of the local monodromy data, which is supposed to be preserved. So it's really only, I think that u is supposed to only go from 1 to n. No, it's correct. Mu goes from 0 to n, because that's the point at infinity, and j goes from 1 to d. Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So if d is 0, then you have no t's. So allow these parameters to deform. And what is the most general deformation that you can allow in the connection, the rational connection matrix, which preserves the monodromy data? Well, in the Fuchsian case, this was answered precisely by Schlesinger in 1905. and I'll write it down, but basically it means that they have to satisfy a very simple set of nonlinear, quadratically nonlinear differential equations called the Schlesinger equations. But the question of what these equations are, which preserve the analog of the Schlesinger equations for non-Fuchsian systems, was unknown in the general case. There were examples until 1980, when it was worked out by, 81, when it was worked out by Jinbo, Miwa, and Ueno, part of the Kyoto School students of Sato. So the answer is essentially this. If I want the monodromy, the generalized monodromy data of Birkhoff to be preserved, then looking at the fundamental system, it must be compatible with an overdetermined system, which include the differentials with respect to the parameters that we're changing. So we have here one component of a connection. You think of it as taking your punctured sphere and essentially taking product with the space of deformation parameters and look at a connection on this huge space, which is integrable. So that means that one wants to have some differential, basically a covariant derivative, which also has components in the direction of the deformation parameters, alpha and the t's. And the form of this deformation equation is uniquely determined in terms of the asymptotic data by this expression. So you just take the principal parts of some, you have to multiply by a polar factor, conjugate the exponential term by the holomorphic term, and take the principal part at each pole. Do the same thing. This is supposed to be alpha, by the way. It's supposed to be the location of the pole. Do a similar expression for the partial derivatives with respect to the pole locations. And so these are the principal parts. And require that this overdetermined system is compatible. So that means a zero curvature condition. So here's the, it's supposed to be differential. I was fixing up my slides this morning. I left out the D. So, okay. So here's equivalent system, overdetermined differential system, where here we have an extended derivative, d tilde, which has a part, which is along the deformation parameters, and a part, which is along the direction in p1. And the statement is that this is really a covariant derivative equation on this extended space, and that has to be compatible. So that means the corresponding curvature is zero. So. Okay. Now, did I write down the zero curvature equation? Yeah, at the bottom. That's the zero curvature condition. So this is a necessary and sufficient condition for the monodromy to be preserved, the generalized monodromy. Now, let's get to the tau function, which is the key ingredient in everything. Jinbo, Miwa, and Ueno observed that if we take these objects, which at the moment are just defined in terms of partial derivatives, I haven't given any geometrical meaning to it, if one takes, you know, the holomorphic part, differentiates it with respect to the parameter on the Riemann sphere, and takes the exponential terms and differentiate with respect to the parameters, and forms such a trace residue at each pole, just call these quantities H, H's, H, A, nu, J, and H, nu. And define this differential form on the space of deformations. Then Jinbo, Miwa, Ueno pointed out that the condition, the zero curvature condition, was equivalent to the fact that this was a closed form. That was a key observation. But they went further because they were inspired by the theory of integrable systems. So first statement is that the zero curvature is equivalent to this being a closed form. This is a scalar form, not a matrix. And so one would like to say that, well, in some sense, it's locally exact, so it should be the differential of something, at least locally, and that something is called the logarithm of the tau function. There is a function locally defined here such that its differential is the closed one form. Now, of course, this function is not really defined as a function. However, it is, when one looks at it carefully, it's defined as a section of a bundle. And really, it's only defined up to multiplication by an arbitrary constant independent of the deformation parameters. And that's what gives the hint that really it should be the section of a suitably defined bundle. I'm not going to define the geometry of it, but there is a suitable, if you like, moduli space over which there's a line bundle and the tau is a section. If you want to fix something familiar to compare it with, think of theta functions over Jacobians of curves as an example along similar lines. So there is actually a globally defined object, tau, but it's not a function. And Miwa showed, and then there was subsequent work, to show that, in fact, where you don't have collisions in the parameter space between poles, that this is actually a holomorphic object, shown by Miwa. Now, Grange developed in much more detail this idea, but the theorem was already known to Miwa. Okay, so let's go back to the simplest case, the Fuchsian case, where all of the Poincaré indices are zero. In that case, we just have first-order poles. The residues are A nu. I've allowed a pole, first-order pole at infinity as well, although Schlesinger, one can always normalize things so that there's no pole at infinity. But I'll just leave the pole at infinity. And then the necessary and sufficient conditions, the Schlesinger equations for the monodromy associated to that Fuchsian system to be invariant up to conjugation. So the equivalence class of the monodromy representation up to conjugation, or if you want, you can fix pole and make it based monodromy, are the Schlesinger equations, which are very simple. They're just second-order differential equations for these residue matrices. And the sum of the residues can be thought of as a residue at infinity, and that has to be constant. Okay, now it turns out that these Schlesinger equations are actually Hamiltonian. They have a Hamiltonian structure. I'll get to that later on. It's a very simple Hamiltonian structure. And they appear in that one form as the partial derivative in the direction of the pole of the logarithm of the tau function. So in fact, the one form that we had before, I'm not sure if I wrote it down, but it's basically, it's a one form on the space of parameters which are only the location of the poles. And its components along each pole is given by this function, and you'll see that this is just the evaluation on the invariant manifolds of a certain Hamiltonian function in the associated phase space. And it's given by this simple expression, trace of the residue at the pole of the trace of the square of the connection matrix A. Okay, simplest example of such a Fuchsian isomonodromic system is when the number of poles is 3, the number of finite poles is 3, so 4 if you count infinity, and the system is rank 2. And for that case, the number of invariants, the eigenvalues of the residue matrices are constants. We can give those values. That gives you 3. Since it's traceless, it means they come in plus or minus pairs. And then you also have the corresponding residue at infinity, which can be normalized to be a diagonal matrix. So it gives you a fourth parameter. It gives you four parameters, theta, 1, 2, 3, and infinity. You can redefine alpha, beta, gamma in terms of these expressions. This is well known. And reduce the whole system under two symmetries, which are trivial. One is conjugation by constant matrices, and the other is basically conformal transformations, I mean linear fractional transformations on the Riemann sphere. So you can reduce that to standardize it, eliminate many of the parameters, and it is reduced from what could be a nine-dimensional system. If you take all of the three traceless matrices that appear, there's a nine-dimensional phase space. But once you reduce it and you put in all these symmetries, it reduces to a two-dimensional phase space. And those are the only non-trivial deformations involved, once you've factored out the Möbius transformations. And suitably parameterized, I'm not giving the details, this is standard, one has either a pair of first-order equations or a second-order equation. I've written it in this second-order form, which is the standard one giving Penglave 6. When you first look at it, it looks horrible, and the longer you look at it, the more familiar it becomes, and all of the structure makes a lot of sense. So this is the generic case of the Penglave transcendent, which corresponds to four first-order poles in the Schlesinger system in rank 2. The other Penglaves are obtained by degeneracies where the degree, the total degree, is still 4, but you might have 2, and every possible partition of 4 gives you a Penglave. So that's the, okay, I think I may have reversed something here because the previous transparency should have said this. We've taken all of the Poincaré indices equal to, this is the next step. So I didn't say exactly what the Hamiltonian structure was, or did I? I'll get back to that later on. But you can anticipate from the notation. Oh, good. I guess they just skipped a lot of transfers. No, that makes sense. That was supposed to be the next one. Okay, so here is the actual Hamiltonian structure of the Schlesinger equation. This has been well known for a long time. Just think of the space of n-tuples of matrices as an element not of SLM to the n, but SLM dual. So because there's a standard Poisson structure on the dual of any Lie algebra, the Lie Poisson structure. And just take that as the product or direct sum structure on n copies of SLM. This is the standard Lie Poisson structure. You use the canonical content of the algebra and dualize, and that gives you, so it says if I want to take the Poisson bracket of two functions, I just take their differentials, think of them as elements of the algebra because we're dealing with functions on the dual, commute them, and then take their scalar product or apply the differential form, apply the form at the location to it. And so that's basically what this formula says. That's the standard Lie Poisson structure. And those are Hamiltonian systems with respect to that Lie Poisson structure. And here the Hamiltonians is the same formula we saw before. The only difference between this and the previous formula is that this is thought of as a function on this phase space, whereas previously it was a function of the parameter. So in fact, we're restricting this function to a smaller, to the leaves of a foliation in which the parameters, the deformation parameters, the poles are the only things that are varying. These are Poisson commutative, and that is what allows the R matrix theory to enter. I mean, you don't see the loop algebra right now, but it's lurking behind in these rational expressions. So the R matrix theory, as a special case of what I'll describe later on, tells you that this will generate on the phase space whose points are such connection matrices with simple poles, will generate a Hamiltonian flow, but if you think of it in a non-autonomous sense, in other words, instead of thinking of the time or the multi-time parameters associated to these Hamiltonians as independent flow variables, you identify them with certain functions on the phase space, namely the location of the pole. So instead of thinking of this as a non-autonomous system, you think of it as an autonomous system, which gives you an extra term. If you only had, if you had independent time variables, which had nothing to do with functions on the phase space, then you would have an isospectral system. That's part of the R matrix theory that gives you that. But, so this is really the Hamiltonian vector field is given by a commutator, where the term that the matrix that you commute with is just the pole term at the specific location. But if you add the fact that this is non-autonomous, then you get an extra term in the equation. Hamilton's equation is no longer just a commutator. It's a commutator plus an extra term, which is, so to speak, the trivial variation in the element A of the, well, think of A as a point in the phase space. And the trivial variation is the one where you simply explicitly, you look at it, and you just explicitly differentiate with respect to the explicit dependence on the alpha parameter due to its being a non-autonomous system. You add that, and there's a small miracle that occurs. This is a derivative with respect to alpha, an explicit derivative. It happens to coincide, if you look at the structure of A, with the derivative of the infinitesimal deformation operator, which is really the Hamiltonian vector field, with respect to the parameter on the Riemann sphere. So these two are equal for this particular case, and that's what converts this. If you ignored this, you'd have an isospectral system. Adding this term turns it into an isomonodromic system, which is manifestly a zero curvature equation, because you have partial derivatives in pairs of directions. Well, you can write it more obviously as a zero curvature equation. I guess I'm not going to go very far, but you should see that here. And basically, we're taking pairs. I guess I didn't write down the general form. But basically, this is the commutator of covariant derivative in two different directions. And this is sufficient to determine all the equations. So the compatibility equation is the Schlesinger system. Now let's go to another case, which I think was the next one that was treated systematically using Poisson structure. That's where we have all of the finite poles are first order, so it would be Fuchsian, but at infinity, we allow a second order, so we put in one extra second order pole. It doesn't matter if it's infinity or any other point. So one second order pole and any number of first order poles. I showed how this system, some years ago, it can also be treated in an analogous fashion using the R matrix Poisson structure. And it goes like this. So we have an extra term that doesn't look like a second order pole, but if you turn this into a differential by multiplying by dx, you see this constant term is actually a second order pole, so that's got Poincaré index 1. So we have more deformations associated to such systems, which are only partially Fuchsian. And once again, one has this differential, which defines a tau function. But now, instead of having only the previous invariants, which were the trace residue invariants of the matrix A, we have to add another set of deformations along the directions of the TAs over here correspond to the eigenvalues of the leading term, A0. Those are the additional deformation parameters. If you look carefully at the definition, that is exactly what the Birkhoff data requires. So now we have additional deformation parameters, M of them, and we have to have a Hamiltonian corresponding to that as well. And it looks a little bit bizarre, but this N, script N, is meant to be A. That's just a typo. And the Y, oh God, the Y, I better write this down. So that's just translating between two different versions. So N is A, and Y is the same thing as what I called. So Y is the diagonal matrix, alpha 1 up to alpha, is that right? No, it's A0. That's just A0. So in terms of that, one can also express the deformation matrix Ka in terms of residues, but you have to take a double residue, one in the parameter lambda and one in the parameter z, which enters through the resolvent of the leading term matrix A0. So take a good look at this, because we're going to see generalization of it later on. So this isn't obviously a spectral invariant, but it turns out that it's just a clumsy way of writing a spectral invariant for the matrix A. So, X is lambda. Okay. So, that's the, now that has a Hamiltonian structure, right? Now, I've just given it by residue theorem, residue formulae, which were already known to Jimbo and Niwa. But now, this completes the definition of the differentials that form the, that define the tau function. So the tau function has components when you take its logarithmic differential along the alpha directions and the t directions. This is the connection form. I guess I didn't give all the data. But here's the form of the Hamiltonian equations. And again, this miracle occurs where the explicit derivative of the connection matrix with respect to the eigenvalues of the matrix A coincide with the partial derivative of the infinitesimal deformation operator, the Hamiltonian vector field, basically, with respect to the location on the Riemann sphere. So we have this notion of explicit derivatives. In the case of Fuchsian systems, it's just the location of the poles, and that you just look at it and you see the presence of the dependence on that parameter. And the same thing for the parameters corresponding to the spectrum at infinity, so to speak. I mean, if we're looking at the point at infinity, then the leading term, the A0, its eigenvalues give you the spectrum of the operator of the matrix at infinity, and those are the only parameters that appear. Now I'd like to, this is a special case of the more general R matrix one, so I'm not going to delve into the details. But now let's look at the general rational case. This was already described in my 1994 paper, but the details of exactly which are the permissible Hamiltonians amongst all the spectral invariants, which are the ones which allow an isomonogromic deformation, they have to satisfy this miraculous relation, which relates the explicit derivatives to derivatives of the Hamiltonian vector field with respect to the coordinate in the Riemann sphere. And so that was identified much later, in fact, just 10 years later, in joint work with Marco Bertolaf, Jacques, and Gabo Fustay. And so I'd like to describe to you this R matrix theory. basically, you look at rational matrices. So that's the object that is parametrizing the connection. And here is a concise form of the Poisson bracket structure. Now, this, if you haven't seen this before, this funny little product, it means two types of products. You're thinking of these as matrices or tensors, and you're simultaneously thinking of Poisson bracket and a tensor product. So that's just a concise way. Here, think of these as endomorphisms of some vector space, Cn. So all of these are endomorphisms or matrices. And it can be written in a commutator form, where this is the identity endomorphism. So you think of it as a tensor product of two copies of Cn. So this is just a concise way to write some relations which could be written out in detail. But it's also Poisson, Lie Poisson structure. But it's a Lie Poisson structure on the dual of loop algebra. And this is maybe a more invariant way to think of it. This so-called R matrix structure can be expressed in terms of endomorphisms of Cm cross Cm, tensor Cm, by simply interchanging the first and second factor and putting in this pole term. This is a standard, this is used to be called the Leningrad, or I guess St. Petersburg notation for the rational R matrix, and was well studied in the theory of integral systems. What was surprising was that it also covered isomonodromic systems, not just isospectral. Okay, so you think of A of X as an element of this loop algebra, or rather the dual of the loop algebra. The previous cases are all just special cases of this. And that can be split into the sum of those loop elements which are holomorphic, which admit holomorphic extension inside the unit circle. If you think of it as a map from the unit circle to the algebra, holomorphic to the inside or holomorphic to the outside, that's plus and minus. And you do a sign flip. You change the Poisson, you change the Lie bracket structure. Instead of the original structure, you think of it as a direct sum of these two subspaces, and you make them independent. That's the so-called split R matrix structure. So you just define a new Lie bracket, which looks like a direct sum, or more precisely, direct difference, because you flip the sign between the two. And now you look at the Lie Poisson bracket for that, and check it, and it gives you this. So that really is a Lie Poisson structure for a so-called split structure. It's not the most general R matrix structure. So this can be thought of as equivalent, like we had a nth power of SLM before. Now we have to take SLM and give its jet extensions. You just get you localize around each pole and think of that as a jet extension of the same order as the Poincaré index. And so in fact, if you just take the Lie Poisson structure on this and make the embedding properly, that coincides with the split R matrix structure. So here's the splitting. The R matrix in that language is simply the difference between the projectors to the plus and minus part. And so as you see, the modified Lie bracket just consists of the difference of the plus part, brackets of the plus parts and the minus parts. Well, I'll spare you the details, but there is this standard split classical R matrix structure. Now, it turns out that if you want to know which flows are being generated in this structure, this is a Poisson structure, it's not a symplectic structure. So we have Casimirs. But what is invariant under all of the flows generated by the spectral invariance is it's sort of self-referential. You take the characteristic polynomial, its coefficients of the spectral parameters, or the spectral invariance, conjugation invariance, and those should be thought of as generators of Hamiltonian flows. And then they all Poisson commute, which means that this spectral curve is an invariant, if it's autonomous. It is not invariant if you make this non-autonomous deformation, so it becomes more subtle. But nevertheless, the spectral curve, which is the characteristic polynomial of the connection matrix, is the relevant geometric object to be studying because it generates the Hamiltonians that provide the isomonodromic deformation. But note that this full ring of spectral invariants is much too big. They do not all satisfy this miraculous condition. Only some of them do. I'm going to have to accelerate. How much time do I have? Okay. So here's the statement. We take elements, Hamiltonians, from this ring of spectral invariants or conjugation invariants. And the corresponding Hamiltonian equation with that Poisson structure is this. It looks, if you're talking about autonomous systems, it looks like a commutator. So you deform A by applying the Hamiltonian vector field to that, and you obtain a commutator. And the term that determines the commutator is you take the differential of the Hamiltonian function, apply this R operator, the R matrix, to it, and work out the commutator. That would be an isospectral deformation. But now we have to take the non-autonomous aspect into account. So the equations of motion are going to be given again by a total derivative, like in the Fuchsian and almost Fuchsian cases, where you have a second order pole. So you're going to have the term, which is a commutator, which is here, and an additional term, which is the explicit derivative. And that's what I'm going to be vague about, because Jacques is in the audience and we haven't quite agreed on what this explicit derivative should be. But there is an explicit derivative, and the point is that if we choose the Hamiltonians carefully enough, and I'll tell you in a moment what they are, then it again satisfies this miraculous equation which says that this explicit derivative coincides with the derivative of the isospectral deformation operator, Hamiltonian vector field, with respect to the location of the Riemann sphere. And that's what makes it into a zero curvature condition. Okay, so the key is that F must be in this ring of spectral invariants, but it can't just be an arbitrary element of the ring of spectral invariants. This is the key condition that it must satisfy. So here we have the deformation parameters. Now this is a theorem. This is simply, you just look at deformation theory and you look at the meaning of the local behavior. You have a function. Now you're thinking of the spectral curve. There's a branched covering. Let me go back. So this is going to be an M-fold branched covering of the Riemann sphere. And Y will be some meromorphic function defined on this spectral curve. It will have M branches. And well, okay, the poles will be determined by the critical points of this. This is going to have poles at, Y is going to have poles at all of the poles, at the alphas and at infinity. So now you can look at the local behavior, the local singular behavior of Y on each sheet of M different sheets in vicinity of each of the poles. And the theorem says that, well, those are going to be spectral invariants because of the way that Y is defined. And the theorem says that the deformation parameters which were defined using the formal asymptotics at infinity coincide with the coefficients of the principal part of this meromorphic function at each pole. So you just take the various terms in the, if you like, the local Laurent expansion of Y, and those give you the deformation parameters. So these are residue formulas. You can think of that as integration around the pole, integral. At the same time, there's a dual relationship. Namely, if here we have positive powers, so that gives you the principal part of Y. But I can also go a certain number of terms in the direction of the holomorphic parts. If I do a Laurent expansion locally, I'll have an equal number of terms in the opposite direction, like mirrors of each other. You've got the polar part, and you've got an equal number of terms in the holomorphic part. And you evaluate those residues. You evaluate those terms, which are essentially residues on the different sheets, and you'll get exactly the same number of objects as the deformation parameters, and these are spectral invariants, and they are the Hamiltonians. They're exactly the Hamiltonians that generate isomonic equations. So that's one of the main theorems. And in particular, you also get the usual Fuchsian type of Hamiltonian, which is the same formula, trace residue, the square of A. So that's the first main theorem. So we've identified exactly which spectral invariants generate isomonodromic deformation. Secondly, well, the equations are exactly the type that must be. So the equations that I wrote earlier of Jimbo, Miwa, Ueno are reproduced if you carefully interpret what is meant by the explicit derivation because of non-autonomous systems. So all the subtlety is in the second term. And so the way that these Hamiltonians, really this is not the Hamiltonian, this is like before, this is just the restriction, the evaluation of the Hamiltonian on the on the surfaces described by the foliation determined by the deformation parameter. So it's really a restriction of some Hamiltonian functions, but these functions really are spectral invariants. So that's defined in a rather, I mean, it's nice to write down, but it doesn't help you very much in explicitly evaluating the way we did for the Fuchsian case and the second order polar infinity. This says, well, it's a residue. You have to know what the local expansion of this this meromorphic function is, why, on the spectral curve. It would be nice to have a formula that does not require you to go to the spectral curve, but actually allows you algebraically to write it down in terms of A of X. There is such a thing. What is it? And one can do that. In fact, one uses a basic formula for perturbation theory, which I won't go into because of lack of time. But if you have a linear operator and you deform it, and you ask the effect on the eigenvalues, then there is a perturbation formula which gives this in terms of residues. I mean, in residues in terms of the resolvent of the operator around which you're deforming. And if you apply that to these operators, which is just A of X with the polar part canceled by adding a corresponding zero, if you apply that, you obtain, using well-known identities from linear algebra, you obtain explicit formulae for these Hamiltonians in terms of just the matrices AX. You don't have to go and calculate the spectral curve and local expansions, and these are the formulae. So you have residue formulae. They look a good deal more complicated, but in any specific case, this is nothing more than a polynomial function of the matrix elements in A and some rational terms. So it's very easy to write these down. And they're the same objects which appear as the coefficients in the polar expansion of that meromorphic function. And also the infinitesimal deformation matrices are given explicitly by matrix residues. So that completes the formula, and it particularizes to the cases we saw before. Do I have three more minutes? Okay, I'd like to just finish. So that's the general theory. I'd like to just finish with one example of applications. And I'll choose the problem of characterizing families of orthogonal polynomials, so-called semi-classical orthogonal polynomials, which means that we're going to look at polynomials, orthogonal polynomials, let's say in the complex plane or in the Riemann sphere, but whose support for orthogonality is along certain curves. And I won't go into the details of this, but not necessarily the real line or the circle. And that gives you a big class of orthogonal, and also the measure, the orthogonality measure, is of the semi-classical type, which means essentially it's the exponential of something that looks like either a logarithm or a rational function. So that includes all the classical orthogonal polynomials and much more. Just enough to get a nice, more or less generic-looking family of isomonodromic deformations. So how does that come in? Well, the polynomial, Pj, is a degree, let's say monic degree xj. Here's the, I haven't specified the orthogonality support, I just said it in words. And here's the measure. So V over here could be a sum, well, here you've got rational terms and logarithmic terms, so that's what I said. That's what I mean by semi-classical. And so we have poles in the measure, I mean in the exponential term in the measure, and also poles at infinity given by this. So we'll call this V the sum of the logarithm of the measure weight. I'll call it a potential because I'm anticipating the application of this to matrix models where it actually appears as a potential in the sense of potential theory. But just let's call V a potential. Then it turns out that the logarithmic derivative can be computed, the logarithmic derivative of, so this is just the measure. I mean, this is just a way to parameterize the measure. And you see these parameters in the deformation, I mean, this is what is the family of measures. So the T's appear a priori as parameters defining the measure. And that's what we're going to change. How do we arrive at an isomonodromic deformation equation? Well, first of all, we normalize, this is just the leading term, we normalize it so that you get normalized orthogonal polynomials. And you introduce the so-called second kind solutions, which is obtained by Cauchy transform or Hilbert Cauchy transform, weighting it with the measure. So you get second type solutions. And then you take two consecutive orthogonal polynomials, J minus one and J, put them all into a 2x2 matrix. This is standard in theory of orthogonal polynomials in the Riemann-Hilbert approach. And you obtain an invertible matrix, psi, whose elements are the polynomials and the second type solutions to the same differential or recursion relations. And you find that that satisfies, first of all, when you differentiate with respect to x, satisfies such a covariant derivative equation. So here we're dealing with a problem with a neuromorphic covariant derivative on, I mean, a rational one on the Riemann sphere. The poles are at the locations indicated. And we automatically get a set of deformation equations just by the definition. You have to just look at the definition, use orthogonality, and so on. And so you find that this overdetermined system is satisfied by these, by this fundamental system. So it's a solution to this class of isomonogramic deformations, which are 2x2. One can make it more explicit. Here I'm saying this is the relation to matrix models. I'm anticipating that there's a thing which is called the partition function. And I haven't described the matrix model relation, but it turns out that the isomonodromic tau function, which is associated with that system, coincides with the matrix model partition function. I can explain that in more detail if anyone's more interested. But so really, when we're studying these orthogonal polynomials, we're actually studying a matrix model. And well, there's one extra term. There's a kind of trivial term that has to be added. But basically, the logarithm of the tau function, the isomonodromic tau function, is the same as the logarithm of the partition function of the matrix model, with the addition of certain very simple explicit terms that you can just write down, rational terms, up to terms that are independent of the deformation parameters. So that's an application. This is actually in a slightly different gauge. I multiplied it by the exponential of V. And the last point, which is going to be a little bit cryptic for those who don't know matrix models, but this strange thing, this is the spectral curve. But it's written down in terms of the data of the matrix model. Here we have that potential V. Think of this as an n by n matrix. And this angle bracket is an integral. It's an evaluation over a multiple integral over the eigenvalues of that matrix. So this is a kind of expectation value of something that can be explicitly written down in terms of the potential, which is the only data that we're varying. That's the measure. Then the spectral curve can be explicitly written down in this nice way, where this differential operator has something to do with generators of the Virasoro algebra. Now, it's also just words for those who are not familiar with it. But if you are interested, I can give you references. So the Virasoro algebra is in this representation given by deformations in the space of parameters of this form. They're linear in the T's. And the operator D is parametrized in terms of these V's and the partial derivatives with respect to alpha. And so in some sense, in this matrix model, the spectral curve has the same data, it's equivalent to knowing the partition function, and it's entirely given by the action of the Virasoro. There's a Virasoro algebra acting on the data, and that uniquely determines it. So for those who know about matrix models, this is a way to interpret the spectral curve in terms of what are called the loop equations, basically Virasoro constraints. Thank you very much.